Failures have affected largely the same area over a 10-day period. In sports, in the NHL, the Blackhawks beat the Hurricanes 2-1. Now, the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service, increasing clouds today, a few sprinkles possible later on this afternoon, cool, a high of 41, a northwest wind at 10 to 15 miles per hour. For tomorrow, sunny, if anything colder, a high of 37, but a warm-up in the weekend is in store for the weekend. In particular, by Saturday and Sunday, we should reach the low 60s. Right now, sunshine and 35. I'm David Cole. WGTD News, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program features two different interviews. A little later in the hour, you'll be hearing from the co-authors of a new book called Chronic, which examines autoimmune disease. First, we're going to be hearing from the archives, a conversation that is actually quite timely because it concerns our sense of smell. You have undoubtedly heard or read that the loss of the sense of smell is often the first indication that somebody has contracted COVID-19. It's often the first symptom to appear and often the last symptom to disappear. My morning show guest for part one, Bonnie Blodgett, lost her sense of smell some years ago, and it had, of course, nothing to do with COVID-19. But this conversation, I think, helps all of us to better appreciate our sense of smell and what it means, how devastating it can be when one loses one's sense of smell or has it very much dramatically altered. So here's part one of today's morning show. I hope that once you are done listening to the next few minutes of the morning show, you will come to a much deeper appreciation for the sense of smell. It's something which all of us tend to take for granted. Not Bonnie Blodgett, the author of a book called Remembering Smell, a memoir of losing and discovering the primal sense. As we are about to hear, Bonnie Blodgett quite suddenly, and one might even say catastrophically on a personal level, suffered the loss of her sense of smell. Actually, first a terribly disturbing distortion of her sense of smell, and then the disappearance of her sense of smell altogether. And it's only when you are deprived of something so essential, even primal to our life as humans, that you have any understanding of just how important this is and how devastating the loss is. Because, of course, it's a loss that is not visible to the eye. And Bonnie Blodgett writes with great candor and care and sensitivity about how difficult all of this was, and about the relationship between this kind of loss and similar experiences which people have with other kinds of disorders. And along the way, as we read this book, we learn a great deal about our sense of smell and some of the mystery which still surrounds it, and of all the ways in which the sense of smell is deeply tied into our daily experience. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I am very grateful to Bonnie Blodgett for making a few minutes available in her day to talk with us. By the way, she is known for Garden Letter, Green Thoughts for the Northern Governor. Garden Letter, Green Thoughts for the Northern Gardener. She has written for a number of different publications and lives in the Twin Cities. Bonnie Blodgett, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for that introduction. You really captured the book. I mean, that's, yes.
Very good. So tell us about the trip that you were making actually through our own fair state of Wisconsin. And you say most readers are not going to know what you're talking about, but most of our listeners will know exactly what we're talking about in terms of the divide between I-90 and I-94. You were driving along, I think, back to the Twin Cities from visiting your daughter who's in college in Madison.
That's right.
Tell us what happened.
Okay. I'd actually been noticing, but trying not to notice, when I was with my daughter at Madison, we had been cooking together. And, of course, you have that, they in Madison have that most wonderful farmer's market. And, you know, we were enjoying all the fresh produce. It was October. But I was noticing as we were cooking and the kitchen was smelling that there was a sort of a metallic, chemically off odor to the food. And as I was driving back home across the state of Wisconsin, the weird off smell became increasingly putrid, and the smells were like sort of rotting everything.
Hmm.
And at first I thought, okay, well, manure, hog manure maybe? You know, I was thinking about the agricultural surroundings. I mean, I came up with every imaginable explanation because I just didn't want to acknowledge the fact that this was strange and scary.
Mm. And, you know, one contrast, which I think helps us understand how bewildering this was, you said at one point, I cracked my window and sniffed the incoming air. To my nose, Wisconsin smells wonderful after the fall harvest, maybe because I grew up around farms.
Yes.
I sniffed again for a blessed moment. I thought I'd solve the riddle of the smell, but the third sniff told me unequivocally, I had not. There was something really, really wrong. And, of course, this sense of something being wrong accompanied you all the way back home to St. Paul.
Yeah. You know, you can, but when you're with other people, you can distract yourself from things like this. But when you're alone in your car, I mean, I thought it was the car for a while. I was worried that it was going to blow up or something. But you know, deep down inside, I knew there was something wrong with my brain. I mean, you know, how you just instinctively, you know, these things. And unfortunately, it took several weeks before I got to the right doctor. I went, my own internist had no idea. She thought I was possibly under a lot of stress and making this all up or something. I mean, I went to see a psychiatrist. After about 6 weeks, I found myself in the office of a near-nose-throat doc who casually informed me that I could no longer smell and that this phantosmia, olfactory hallucinations, is a sort of a precursor to anosmia, not always, but sometimes. And, of course, my theory is that it is all tied into evolution, and we are smelling creatures more than we are thinking creatures. That's why I refer to smell as the primal sense. The brain really freaks out when you lose your sense of smell. It's like phantom limb pain. It's the same type of syndrome.
Explain to our listeners what almost certainly was the direct culprit here, the medication, if we want to call it that, that you had taken some time before.
Yeah, I had a cold coming on, and I really never take cold remedies. I don't really mind getting a cold, but my husband had brought this thing home called Zicam, and he said his neurologist friend in L.A. just swore by this, and everyone in California was using it. It works, blah, blah, blah. I thought, oh, well, what the hell. Back then, it came in a package that did not deliver the chemical, you know, very in a very well-regulated way. And so lots of people were getting too much of it up their noses. It's called zinc gluconate, and it has been shown actually decades ago to be toxic to smell. But the company that makes it has been very quietly settling complaints and lawsuits with money. And when I found out that Zicam had taken out my sense of smell, my ENT doc told me that pretty unequivocally. He said, you know, everything you're describing, it really hurt horribly when it was a burning sensation. I knew, oh boy, I've done something.
You wrote at one point, so this is how cattle feel under a branding iron. I mean, that's the level of discomfort we're talking about.
That's exactly what I thought.
And what was the...
I had to take a pain reliever to get to sleep. It was really intense.
And how long was it between that and when you began to notice things going wrong with your sense of smell? Are we talking about days or weeks?
It was. It's hard to say because when you have a cold, you don't smell normally. But and by the way, cold viruses can also destroy olfactory cells. And the company that makes Zicam uses this as the defense. You know, well, you didn't. It wasn't the medication. It was the cold. My doc said, nah. He had had so many people coming into him with this problem. So. But getting back to the question of when, how long did it take? Probably a week or two. As I said, I mean, I was sort of smelling things, taste of things was off for some time before I started to realize there was something really seriously wrong. Yeah. And so I would say a week or two. And then the phantasmia itself, the olfactory hallucinations, lasted 6 weeks. Or so, 2 months, maybe. You know, it was Christmas time when they finally went away, and that was the result of another medication I took. My doctor gave me that is mysteriously tricks the brain, as he put it, into thinking that everything's okay, and it doesn't need to keep producing these vile smells.
Mm. So, you walked out of that ENT's office. Told that you would suffer these phantom hallucination smells for a while, and once they ended, your sense of smell would be gone.
Precisely.
Wow.
And he was correct to the day. He said, you will not be smelling the vile odors by Christmas, and it was actually the day after Christmas I woke up, and my head was clear.
Hmm.
So anosmia had begun.
Right. And he said to you, you will find it, in a sense, to be a relief. But, of course, it was just the end of one suffering and the start of another. One of the things you tell us really again and again, and I'm glad you do because it's important for us to understand, is this is the kind of loss that is all but impossible for anybody else to understand. I mean, and even your own children and your own husband and your friends really had were essentially clueless when it came to understanding just what kind of a loss this was for you.
Right, right. And that's, you know, I mean, if you really think about it, you can't see the disability. I mean, I'm not walking around with a white cane. I don't have a cast on my arm. I seem perfectly normal. I will tell you that I was self-conscious that perhaps I was trying too hard to behave normally because I was inside so, so devastated and sad and disconnected. I just felt completely disconnected, and I think it was a combination of the trauma of just the knowledge that I'd lost my sense of smell, which I've always really loved. I'm a gardener and a cook and really sort of depended on, frankly, for my sense of equilibrium and well-being. I think most of us do, but... you know, the fact that I didn't want to talk about it. I knew that if I mentioned it, that the person I told I couldn't smell would forget almost immediately, because that's what happened. So there was really no point in trying to share this. And I think humans also really depend on the empathy of other humans to be happy and to feel grounded. If you have something wrong with you that no one else can really relate to, and that furthermore they think is no big deal, it's hard because you are all alone with this.
Right. You tell such a poignant story of being in a house full of company. I can't remember now if it was your own house or somebody else's, I think around the holidays, and you kind of sequestered yourself for a little while and really wanted to just stay up there, and you were kind of imagining if people knew why you were feeling sad and not wanting to be with people, that they would be rolling their eyes and thinking, well, what would Bonnie do if something really serious happened to her? I mean, instead of being, you know, laid low by this thing, which really doesn't matter so much, except it does.
Except it only does.
You could know, as someone who'd suffered this loss, just how much this matters to our happiness and well-being.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And since this book came out, which was like only about 2 days ago, but people have been reading about it, reviews of it and stuff. And I mean, I've just been getting bombarded with emails from fellow sufferers. I no longer am one, but people who are still dealing with it, coping with it, desperate. Do you know anybody? Do you know a doctor? What can I do? And then segueing very quickly into just wanting someone to share this with. Just let me tell you about it. Let me tell you how it feels to me. Many people have this phantosmia, or it's also known as parosmia, and they want to tell you what their smells are like, and when they come and when they go, and what triggers this and that, and there's just been this outpouring. I think many, many, many more people suffer from smell dysfunction than the statistics show. Statistically, it's 5% of us in this country, but really, who knows? Because most people who lose their sense of smell aren't big babies like I am. They simply suck it up and go on about their lives.
One of the things which is, this is devastating on a couple of different levels. One of them has to do really directly with just what we smell around us, and particularly in our home. This is what you write at one point. My house, with all its marvelous smells, was my refuge, my joy and comfort, the only place that could persuade time to slow down, back off, and sometimes at very special moments, like when I was cleaning and became distracted by a book, even stop altogether. I could revel in the house's sensuality, not just the smells, but the images they summoned, the people and moments when we had all been so much younger. I opened my eyes, the smells such as they were, vanished. What would my home be like now? Not just this chair, but my garden, my kitchen. This room, stripped of its layers of fragrance, was a barren cell. I wonder what it was like.
It took me back there. Thanks a lot.
I was going to say, I mean, boy, that segues beautifully into what I wanted to ask you with, which was, what did it feel like to write this book and to revisit this pain? I mean, I can't imagine somebody writing that vividly without vividly feeling the pain all over again.
When I wrote that, I was not smelling, so I was right in the thick of it. This book took me 4 years to write. 3 years, I tend to exaggerate. It seemed like four. Between 3 and 4 years. This happened to me in the fall of 2005, and I immediately put on my writer-journalist hat, which is what I do when I'm scared and when I'm upset. I turn into the reporter, and I get an assignment to write about the thing that's scaring me or fascinating me. This has been my habit in the past. So I plunged into a study of olfaction, and this led, because smelling is such a cutting-edge topic in brain science right now, this led to interviewing geneticists, evolutionary biologists, all sorts of really impressive people. And it really got me through the horror of anosmia, because I was able to just not think about it in a bad way. I couldn't think about anything else. I could think about it in a constructive way. I could learn. So I actually wrote those passages in which I was describing the drive from Madison through from Madison, the memoir part of the book. I wrote that first. And
in the throes of this experience.
Yeah, and so the reason why it feels credible is because that's the way it was.
Wow.
I mean, I really, truly didn't know. I didn't know if I was going to make it. Hmm. I thought, I just didn't think I was going to be able to, like, let go of this. I was obsessing
right
on this.
One of the things about losing the sense of smell is not only you can't just directly smell things, and that's devastating enough,
sure.
But you talk also about how smell is so significant a part of our sense of taste. You
mm-hmm.
Somebody suggests maybe 90% of our sense of taste actually is tied up in smell.
Mm-hmm.
You write this at one point: when you can't smell, the simpler and more familiar the food, the more traumatic its transformation. Buttered toast, the ultimate comfort food, is no longer familiar. You've been conditioned through long years of exposure to expect toast's symphony of delightful sensations, beginning with the sweet aroma, then the liquid saltiness on the tongue, and finally the crisp yet chewy feel between the teeth. There is no way to describe the revulsion that attaches itself to the poor excuse for the food that every fiber of your being is begging for. As you kind of explored this, how taste and smell are tied together, also came to a new appreciation for the plight of at least many people who are overweight. You had not really come to understand how, for at least some people who are overweight and who overeat, it is in fact a very complicated problem to solve.
That's right. And what I discovered after losing 15 pounds immediately, when I was really in the throes of phantosmia and just food was pretty repulsive, I began eating robotically. Just, you know, food becomes fuel when you can't smell. But also, if you can't smell, the hormones that control hunger and satiety are confused and messed up, and they just stop working properly. So you don't get those signals, those sort of subliminal signals that I'm full now. And satiety, the feeling of being satiated, satisfied, full, these are emotional feelings. Smell is very tied in with our emotions. It is literally, it's right there in the limbic system where emotion and memory happen. So when you, not only do you not feel full, that feeling of having a lot of food in your stomach, I can't eat another bite, you feel emotionally full as well because of these hormones. When they're not working anymore, you keep on eating because you keep on wanting the feeling, the familiar feeling of satiety, of being satisfied. You don't really know you're doing it, but you just keep on eating until you are what? Not satisfied, not full. And suddenly you're looking at the scale and, oh my God, I'm getting fat. So I think scientists are now looking into the whole issue of satiety as it relates to obesity and trying to figure out, when people reach a certain weight, how is that affecting those hormones? And is there a way that we can use those hormones to help people who are overweight, to get those signals working properly?
Hmm. You have a fascinating chapter called Olfactory Art, which begins with this sentence: only humans deliberately create smells. People compose tantalizing perfumes and then package them in luminous glass bottles that are often etched to catch the light and create patterns as mesmerizing and as evocative as the scent within. I'm guessing that once you lost your sense of smell, you had a new appreciation for instance, perfumes.
Yes, and what's interesting is that I never thought of myself as a perfume girl. I mean, I'm not really a girly girl. That's probably because I'm such a gardener. I'm always filthy. But yes, and not only the way perfumes are made and why they smell the way they do, and the incredibly highly educated noses of the noses, as they're called, the perfume designers, smell can be trained. In fact, smell is a learned sense. We learn to like the foods, for example, that we, because we have the unique, humans have the unique capacity to experience flavor. We have a thinking brain that enhances our sense of smell enormously. We tend to think that we don't need smell. Dogs die if they can't smell. But here's what we do have. We have the ability to appreciate perfumes and flavor, things that other creatures don't, because we are thinking, and because our thinking is wired to our limbic system to do this for us. It's really quite miraculous and wonderful. The way that perfume is bottled, how beautiful visually and how evocative of the smell inside. This is a wonderful way of thinking about our sensory system and how it actually works.
Right.
The senses are very much intertwined.
And yet what's really interesting also for you in this experience is how you learn of smell being its own sort of peculiar sense that doesn't operate quite the same as the others. You've really experienced this as spring came around. You wrote, spring was coming, and with it the lilacs, lilac time. The word alone, lilacs, brought visions of spring's past, but
yes.
No fragrance. I was again reminded that smell differs from hearing and sight in that it cannot be remembered. You can dredge up a tune or picture a long-lost loved one's face, but you can't conjure a scent out of whole cloth, even with the help of a memory. I would never smell spring again, even in my mind's eye.
Yeah. You know, I've had so many debates about that. In interview, or actually, Melissa Block and All Things Considered got into it with me after our interview was over. And she said, I just got to raise that issue with you, Bonnie. Are you sure that we can't conjure up a smell? I can. And I said, what smell would that be? She said, well, my very first memory is of myself smelling, at probably around age 2, a baby bib. And I can still smell that. I'm thinking about it now, and damn it, I'm smelling it. And all I could say is, you know, humans have amazing, wonderful imaginations, and that's why you think you can smell it.
Hmm.
But it's really the picture in your mind of the bib and all of the subsequent experiences that you've had smelling that plasticky smell. And I said, you know what, Melissa, I'm smelling it myself right now that you mention it. And oil cloth, that's another very evocative smell. But if you actually talk in terms of biology, we are not smelling those things the way we see things and hear things in our memories, the way we can conjure up. We can actually sing a tune that we remember. We can sing it, you know. We can describe a person's face from memory, but any conjured up smell that we're smelling is really 100% imagination.
And that was proved in your experience, because I mean,
yes.
Here you were, eating some wonderful food, prime
yeah.
rib,
yeah.
and you've eaten prime rib before. Theoretically, you should be able to remember what prime rib smells like, and yet. It's gone.
It did me no good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I didn't know if we would reveal this, but you yourself revealed it a little earlier in the interview that, in fact, you no longer are without your sense of
yeah.
smell. And we find that out at the very end of the book. I'm just
yeah.
curious. You actually don't spend very much time at all. I mean, it's practically the last page of the book mm-hmm. when we finally discover this, that
yeah.
that your sense of smell returned. I'm just wondering if there's any particular reason why you didn't dwell on the return of your sense of smell any more than you did.
You know, there was really nothing more to say. I talked to my editor about this a lot. I did, in fact, add quite a bit to the description of getting my sense of smell back, because she wanted me to tell readers whether it came back gradually or not. And that's a question I'm always asked. When did you first notice, and when did you know for sure? And I do tell that story in the book, and I talk about how I was smelling things faintly, like popcorn, real strong smells, popcorn and dog poop and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. But I knew too much. I knew how the imagination can play tricks. I didn't want to get my hopes up. I'd read a story by Oliver Sacks about a man who literally talked himself into thinking, he walked into the doctor's office and said, it's back, I can smell again. And Dr. Sacks didn't have the whatever, you know. He didn't have the heart to tell him, no, you're not smelling, you just think you are. So I didn't want to fool myself. So I kept saying, well, no, I'm not really smelling that. That's not real. I'm just picturing something. But then it was when I was in my garden and I smelled catmint, which is a very distinctive odor. I knew that I couldn't make that up. And I was really, my nose was just getting flooded with this because I was kind of on my hands and knees poking around in the garden, and I have a lot of catmint in my garden. That's when I knew for sure. And then when a thunderstorm came and I could smell the sky, I could smell the cloud, I could smell the air. It smelled real. The world smelled real to me again, and full and rich and like coordinated. Everything was making sense. In a way that I just, there was no mistaking it.
And in a way that you'll never take for granted again.
Yeah, and I do describe somewhere in the book, probably earlier, that the way, the scientific explanation for why we can get our sense of smell back, even though the other nerves in the brain do not regenerate, the olfactory nerve does. And so I knew that there was a tiny chance that if I had any stem cells left up there, they could divide and repair, you know, heal. It doesn't usually happen, but in my case it did. I just didn't want to believe ever. I didn't want to be just bitterly disappointed. So that's why didn't dwell on that too much. And then once it was, I mean, what can you say? It just, we all know what it's like to be able to smell. I didn't have to tell you that.
Right. But it's funny. It's like we get done with your book, and now in a whole different way we know what it's like to be able to smell anything.
And please, please smell the roses, smell the coffee, take time out. Take time out to develop your sense of smell, because that's what people with the professional noses, I referred to the perfumers and so on, that's what, those people have something special that most of us don't have. We develop our appreciation for music, we develop our appreciation for art. Very few of us develop our appreciation for smells in the, unless we're wine drinkers, then we do. But and that would be my, you know, hold that thought, you know, take time out, learn to love your sense of smell.
The book is called Remembering Smell, a memoir of losing and discovering the primal sense, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author Bonnie Blodgett. Bonnie Blodgett, I'm really glad we had the opportunity to speak with you about your fascinating and moving book, and I'm glad that your sense of smell is back, and we wish you very, very well in all the years ahead and all your future writing.
Oh, thank you so much. This was very, very fun. I loved it.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two guests with us for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show to talk about a very new and important book called Chronic, The Hidden Cause of the Autoimmune Pandemic and How to Get Healthy Again. This is a book co-written by Dr. Stephen Phillips and someone who was a patient of his, Dana Parrish, well-known singer and songwriter, and they have together not only written this book, but also both experienced the terrible difficulty that can be part of an autoimmune problem. And the book explores some very interesting possibilities about what might be behind this so-called pandemic, and also ways in which we might rise to this challenge. Dr. Stephen Phillips and Dana Parrish, we welcome both of you to The Morning Show.
Thanks you so much.
Glad to have you both here. Dr. Phillips, if I understand correctly, both you and Dana Parrish have experienced this this physical ailment in your own lives. I'd love to hear from both of you briefly about that. Let's begin with you, Dr. Phillips.
Sure, thank you. I was sleeping in my bed. I got spider bites. Within a couple of months, my body exploded. I thought nothing of the spider bites. Who thinks to treat spider bites with meds? And within 6 months of those bites, I couldn't walk on my own. I went to 25 doctors that couldn't help me, including three rheumatologists, infectious disease, neurologists, everybody. and I was given diagnoses of rheumatoid arthritis and arthritis of my spine, but I got very, very sick. I got anemic and fevers every night, 102. Ended up needing 24-hour home care, and I didn't walk for 2 years. And I figured it out in the last minute and got myself better and saved my life, and I have a really full life now, and I travel around giving lectures and run around all the time. And, you know, I went back to my three rheumatologists when I got well, and I said, is this going to change how you treat your patients? And they're like, no. It's just it was too much for them. And so I figured I don't know what to do, so we wrote a book to get the information out there.
Interesting. How about you, Dana Parrish? Tell us about your very real-life brush with this this situation, this problem.
Yeah, so I got a tick bite one summer in 2014, came back to, I was out of the city for a day, came back to Manhattan, and I saw a bite in a bullseye, got 3 weeks of antibiotics right away from the doctor around the corner, and was told I would be fine. And then 3 months later, I woke up, my whole body was haywire. I had fibromyalgia, severe body pain, weakness, crushing fatigue, anxiety, depression, insomnia. I'm right at the height of my career. I absolutely cannot even get out of my apartment anymore. I can barely breathe. And by December, I really was very, very short of breath. And I got an echocardiogram from my doctor's colleague, and I found out I was in heart failure. And I had seen 12 top New York City doctors in all this time, including 3 infectious disease doctors, and nobody would connect my symptoms, as much as I asked, to the tick bite. And I still had ongoing Lyme disease. It was undertreated. And when I saw Dr. Phillips, thank God somebody sent me to him, he also discovered another infection called Bartonella that was given to me during that tick bite, and he treated both of the infections, and all of my symptoms went away, including my anxiety and depression and insomnia. So I want people to know that a lot of times these symptoms are not what you think. They're not just out of nowhere and for no reason. There's a really good and common reason, and these infections are very, very common, and they commonly cause my symptoms and Dr. Phillips' symptoms and many, many others. So that's the big dirty secret. Infections cause chronic and autoimmune and psychiatric illness.
So Dr. Phillips, explain to us exactly what is going on in the body that causes this situation. I mean, what is it about a given infection, such as both of you have described, that would lead to this much more serious and ongoing situation? What exactly is going on in the body? What exactly is the connection?
Sure. So the common denominator between all of these infections, and in the book we do a deep dive in Lyme because that's the one that everyone has heard of, but there are many, many similar infections that people have not heard of. Some of them are really not related to Lyme at all, but they have similar qualities. Like the common denominator is they're very slow-growing infections, so they cause kind of chronic inflammation. People are taught all the time that inflammation is the root cause of many diseases. It's not really the root cause. Something is causing the inflammation. So we say, okay, what's the root cause of inflammation? And over the past 100 years of medicine, the wisdom has been that the most common cause of chronic inflammation has been infections. And then somehow that very, very important piece of wisdom has been forgotten and been replaced with, it sprung up this theory of autoimmune disease, you know, that the body is just attacking itself for no reason. Well, there is a reason, and it's driven by chronic low-grade infections. So that is the main message of the book, that we're missing the key player, and we have to go after that.
So in your case, for instance, Dr. Phillips, where what set this in motion was spider bites, which caused an infection, which set in motion these other events that were really pretty catastrophic in their impact on your life. By the time you sorted out this connection, were those initial infections from those spider bites still present in your body, or are we talking about some other kind of follow-up infections?
No. It was raging. It was raging.
So that those initial infections did not simply clear up?
No, unfortunately. It's not like the flu. You know, they just stay around. So many of these infections, when they're not treated, they persist. It's the nature of it. I mean, again, Lyme is the one that everyone knows about, and Lyme persists in the body if it's not treated. And it doesn't make everybody very sick, but it can kill people, too. And it's like that with all of the other infections. Dana mentioned Bartonella. Bartonella can make some people very, very sick, and that's the one that got me also. Or it can make some people not very sick. And we don't know why some people get incredibly sick like I did, and some people get somewhat a little bit less sick, and some people don't get sick at all. But that's one of the hard parts for doctors to get their heads around, and it confuses everybody.
Dana Parrish, you received treatment, which did ultimately lead to a relief from all the suffering that you were experiencing. Take us through exactly what that that treatment from Dr. Phillips entailed.
Sure. Well, the first thing I should say is that I was finally properly diagnosed. And once he made the diagnosis, he knew that there were specific antibiotics and other drugs like antimicrobials and even some supportive herbal therapies that would treat my symptoms. So he came up with a really tailored plan. And I took some really simple, cheap, generic antibiotics, nothing fancy, you know, tetracycline, things people have heard of before. And it got me better. And over the course of a couple of months, you know, within 2 months, my heart failure was gone. I think that's very, very significant. And the cardiologist even called Dr. Phillips to say, hey, how did you do that? What was going on? And really educated him. And my fibromyalgia, my anxiety and depression also went away within the first couple of months. And then slowly, you know, the rest of my symptoms, you know, I had some joint pain and some body pain and those kinds of things. They waxed and waned for a bit. But I was very, very well by, you know, June, July. And within a year, I was completely done with my treatment with him and feeling great and back to my life. And I even say I felt better than I did before I got that tick bite, to be honest with you.
So, Dr. Phillips, is what you're saying that the medical community has absolutely no understanding of this, no knowledge of this, or that for some strange reason they are not receptive to this possibility that there is this connection?
I think that innovation is always going to be a deviation from the norm, but I think we have to understand, and I don't mince my words, that the medical community is in large part led around by pharma, and there's not much money in cures. You know, they cured hepatitis C very well, and there's been business analyses of that, of those drugs that cure hepatitis C, saying they're basically business failures because they cured the patients, and they don't end up being as profitable as drugs that suppress symptoms for the 40 years or the rest of the life of the patient. So I think that there are, you know, scientific reasons that it hasn't caught on, but also there are other kind of, you know, darker reasons that are, you know, profit-driven. And I wish it weren't the case, but pharma has a huge role in how doctors think and behave.
So what is your advice for people who are listening to this interview or who will read your book, Chronic? What are people to do with this information in terms of their own lives? I mean, I'm especially thinking about somebody who does not find themselves in the grips of a terrible autoimmune disorder, but perhaps might down the road.
Right. The problem is it's Russian roulette. I mean, it really, listen, if it happened to me with all the access to medical care and you know, medical training that I had, it can literally happen to anyone. So I think that what people need is a team of doctors, really, that treat the patient like a puzzle and not just slap a label on their back and get them out the door. I mean, people have to go down some rabbit holes, have to collaborate with other experts just to treat with symptom-suppressive drugs. I mean, it's important when people are suffering because you don't want anyone to suffer. But the concurrent, you know, additional goal that you have is to get at the cause. And if you're not getting at the cause, you're never going to cure anything if you don't get at the cause of the symptoms. It's just, it's not possible.
So as much as anything, this book is addressed to the medical community or the scientific community to, in a sense, wake up to this connection.
Yeah, yeah. It's heavily, heavily referenced. At one point, the publisher's like, stop putting in all these references. It's not a textbook. But I wanted it to be where doctors can read it and really, really learn stuff and make it user-friendly and very accessible to non-doctor folks as well. So it's a very fine line to walk, but I think we straddled it pretty well.
Right. By the way, Dr. Phillips, is this so-called pandemic of autoimmune disorders, is this something that is especially serious here in the United States, or is this something we're seeing around the globe?
It's global. I did speaking tours in Europe in 2015, 2016. It was like my heart-wrenching to see. They have less access to care than we even have here in the United States. And one of the interviews we did in the book was a man from Ghana, from Africa. We call him Ghana Joe in the book. And he's a nurse, and he got very, very sick. And Dana, why don't you tell the story of Ghana, because he contacted you initially.
Yeah, he got really sick, and he had stumbled upon my story. I was writing a column about this for the Huffington Post, and began with my own story, and he read it, somehow contacted me through my music website, and asked me for help. So I spoke to Dr. Phillips, and there was a protocol that was public, some guidelines. We sent those to him. And he not only followed them, he educated a bunch of doctors in the hospital that he worked with, that he worked at, and they treated him. He got totally better. Now he's teaching other nurses and doctors about how infections spread by different ways can cause all this psychiatric. His symptoms were mostly anxiety and depression and mostly psychiatric. He had a little joint pain and stuff, but those were the things that were really debilitating for him. They went away. We actually just spoke with him and followed up a couple weeks ago, and he's doing fabulous. He's been better for about 2 years now. So this information can help people all over the world, and that's why we wrote the book. We really want to help people.
Very good. And Dr. Phillips, briefly, I know that you have thoughts about connections between COVID and chronic sufferers of certain symptoms of people who have recovered from COVID. Do you touch on that in your book as well?
Yes, we have a chapter on COVID, and we focus on long COVID. And for people who buy the hardcover, they should know there's a free download for the chapter at thechronicbook.com. The COVID chapter is currently available in the Kindle version and the Audible book. It's just because as we were writing the book and finishing up, COVID exploded, and we're adding the chapter furiously, so we didn't hit the deadline for the hardcover, but it'll be out in the next printing soon.
Very
good.
Hardcover
as well. And, yeah, okay.
Chronic, the hidden cause of the autoimmune pandemic and how to get healthy again. The co-authors, Dr. Stephen Phillips and singer-songwriter Dana Parrish. Thank you so much. Thanks to you both. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview that was originally scheduled to air last week with writer L. Annette Binder and her marvelous novel, which is titled The Vanishing Sky. This novel focuses on a German family, a mother, a father, and two sons who are living through the waning months of the Second World War, trying to hold their family together as the nation of Germany disintegrates around them. In the case of the one son, he is just back from battle and is bearing the scars of what we now know to be PTSD. And the mother struggles to know what to do to help her son. The younger son is part of Hitler's Youth, which is a group of young people that, as the Second World War came to an end, were conscripted more and more into actual combat duties and so on, because there were no adult men left to step into the fray. These events in this novel are loosely based on some of the experiences of her own father in Germany. It's a remarkable novel, and I'm very excited to share with you the interview that I recorded with L. Annette Binder on tomorrow's morning show. By the way, we'll be on Easter break on Friday and on Monday, but each day there will be a morning show offered up through the podcast of the program. You can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu.